Hi, I'm Femi Oke. Today on the stream, we're going to be discussing reframing American history from a particular perspective that takes us back to 1619. The creator of the 1619 Project that starts American history from the moment that black Africans stood on the soil of the United States as we know it now, that project has now brought forth a book called The Origin Story, a new origin story, The 1619 Project. The creator of that book and the project is with us right now, Nicole Hannah-Jones. Thank you, Nicole, for making time for us on the stream. When you introduce yourself to international audiences, what parts of your background do you pick out to share with them?
Well, I'm a journalist at The New York Times, and I've spent my career really writing about racial inequality in the United States and the way that our history here shapes the society that we live in.
I have seen you on stage do a one-paragraph version of what often many kids are taught about black Americans in U.S. history. It's slightly tongue-in-cheek, but it's also pretty shocking. Can you just do that very quick recap? Because audiences, black audiences, start to laugh, but I think it's a knowing laughter about, yep, that was all we were taught.
I'm not sure which one you're talking about because I'm on stage.
And then there was Martin Luther King Jr. and then there was the Black Lives Matter, and then that was the end. That version of history that often we're taught at school.
Yes, I mean, I talk about how we get Black History Month, and that typically you get about four people in Black History Month. So you learn about Martin Luther King, you learn about Harriet Tubman. Depending on where, you might learn about Frederick Douglass. And then that sums up our entire experience. And that, of course, makes us think that Black people haven't contributed that much to our society. And so we all end up knowing the same handful of names, but don't really get a greater understanding of the contributions that Black Americans have made.
I'm going to show our audience a picture of you on stage with a very special person who introduced you to the depth of what Black Americans had brought to the United States. Tell us who this is and why he's important to you.
So that is Mr. Ray Dial. And Mr. Ray Dial was my high school teacher. He taught the course was called the African American Experience. And it was a one semester Black Studies course. And in that course, I learned more about the history and contributions of Black Americans and Black people across the globe than I learned in my entire career. And I talk a lot about how the erasure of Black people from the American and global story was very powerful. It sends just as much of a message as what we do learn. What we don't learn sends the same type of message. And so once I took that course, I became obsessed with learning that history. And Mr. Dial was also the educator who encouraged me to join my high school newspaper. When I complained about the fact that our high school paper didn't write about the Black kids like me, who were all bused into the school as part of an effort to try to desegregate the school. So he's very pivotal in my life.
Nicole Hannah-Jones is here for the next 25 minutes. If you'd like to talk to her, ask her questions about the 1619 Project and the new origin of the 1619 Project, the comment section is right here. Join our conversation. I'm going to introduce a new voice into our discussion, Nicole, and this is Jose. He has a question for you on video. When you hear the question, go ahead and answer it.
I believe that the 1619 Project does an excellent job of ensuring that we not only have a discussion about becoming more inclusive as a country for Black Americans, but how we can also teach future generations about the harms that we need to still repair for millions and millions of people who have considered themselves Americans against all odds. How did your reporting over decades around educational inequality inform the current projects that you've undertaken with the 1619 Project and Born on the Water?
So I know Jose, actually, so that was a bit of a surprise. So I have, in some ways, spent my decades, two decades, as a journalist, trying to get back to 1619 and the significance of that date, because in writing and reporting on racial inequality, I've always understood that it wasn't enough to just write about what is happening today, that Black people suffer disparities across nearly everything that you can measure, that we had to show why and how we got here, and that there were policy decisions, that there were laws, that there were customs, that there were economic policies that led us to be where we are. And so I've always tried to infuse my work with historical understanding, because most Americans, frankly, get almost no history or sociology about the construction of race and the way that race and racial inequality has been intentionally created. Mm-hmm. So much of my work as a journalist, but also just my work as kind of a lay historian, my undergraduate degrees are in history and African American studies. I read on this history obsessively. All the books in my house are about Black American history, really. And so all of that really informed my idea to pitch the 1619 Project, which the conceit of the project is that all across American life, in ways that are surprising, we can see the legacy of slavery, even though that legacy often operates invisibly.
Nicole, I'm picking out some of the pictures from the new origin story because that's somewhat different from the original 1619 Project. The project goes on and on and on, but this iteration, the photos really stand out. What were you trying to do, you and your collaborators?
Yes. Yeah, so the idea to put these archival photos in really came from the editor, one of the co-editors on the project, Caitlin Roper, with the initial project, when I pitched it, a small group of us from the New York Times Magazine took a field trip to the National Museum of African American History and Culture. And Caitlin was really struck by all of the images there of just regular Black people who were not famous, just living their lives. And she realized she'd never really seen many of these images in popular culture. And that humanity that we saw in those photos really stuck with her. So when we decided to turn this into a book, she really believed that one of the things we should do is include these archival photos. And that's how they came to really start every essay in the book. And I found a really wonderful photo curator on Instagram, actually, mm-hmm. Kimberly Anise Henderson. And she runs a site where she goes through and posts pictures of regular Black Americans going all the way back to the beginning of photography. And so we collaborated with her. And I think it is such a beautiful way to force the reader before every essay, because these essays are difficult. They talk a lot about, you know, the brutality, the barbarism that Black Americans had to face. But before you enter every essay, you have to pause and just look at a regular Black person in his or her full humanity and realize that everything you're about to read happened to real people with hopes and dreams and hurts and pains just like anyone else. And it's actually one of my favorite parts of the book.
The idea of having a new origin story for the United States of America, some people were shaken by this in good ways and also in bad ways. Let me share with you a website that focuses on education. And they've been tracking the efforts in 28 states to restrict educational racism, bias, and the contributions of specific racial and ethnic groups to US history or related topics, which becomes doubly shocking when you realize that the United States, as we know it, is a nation of immigrants. Then they tracked 15 states that are trying to expand educational racism, bias, and the contributions of specific racial or ethnic groups to US history or related topics. There is the debate. There is the debate, Nicole, that you and your collaborators started in conversation 2 years ago and continue in conversation now. What happened? What was the impact of the project?
Well, the impact of the project has, in ways good and bad, exceeded everything that we could have possibly imagined. I think every journalist hopes that you will produce journalism that has a larger societal impact and that gets people to really think. And what this project was intentionally trying to do was unsettle our mythology about what the America is, what America was founded upon. You know, I don't have to tell your international audience that many Americans believe in this idea of exceptionalism, that we are an exceptional nation, that we are exceptionally free, and that we are the greatest experiment in democracy that the world has ever seen. But the only way that you can believe that is you have to erase large swaths of our history. You have to erase genocide and Indian removal and settler colonialism and the theft of land. You have to erase 250 years of chattel slavery. And so we have done that in this country. And when you take a piece of popular history in the paper of record, one of the most powerful media institutions in the world, and you say, actually, 1776, the year of the that we marked the founding of the United States, doesn't actually tell you that much about America. But the year 1619, where we engage in African slavery, where we kind of see our founding tensions, our founding divides begin, that tells you a lot more about this country. And when you say even that we are a nation of immigrants, well, yes and no. We have been a multiracial place since 1619, when Africans joined indigenous people who were already here, who are not immigrants, and English immigrants who chose to come here. And then, of course, Africans who were forced migrants to the United States. And we really are a multiracial nation made up of many people who chose to be here, but also significant numbers of people who did not.
That's a good point. I even think the framing of 1619 doesn't take into account the people who were already in the United States before other people came to the United States. Ian Gibson is having a conversation with you on YouTube. He wants to know, how do you rationalize, Nicole, the fact that your book is being banned from being taught in schools?
I don't rationalize it. I think it's absurd. I think it's astounding that you would have all across a country who believes, or at least exports to the world, this idea that we believe in free speech, that we are an open society, that we are a tolerant society, that you would have legislatures banning books, banning ideas, using the state to criminalize the teaching of ideas that they don't like. This is a work of New York Times journalism, and legislators are banned the teaching of this project by name in Georgia, in Florida, in Texas, and other states are also attempting to do that. So it's antithetical to the idea that Americans want to have of themselves and the idea that Americans want to export to the world. All we have to do is ask ourselves, if this were happening in Cuba, or if this were happening in China, how would Americans talk about the banning of books, the burning of books, and the criminalizing of the teaching of ideas? We know how we would respond to that. So I think it is very disturbing, and it reflects on, I think, the very precarious position that American democracy sits in right now.
A comment from Spenny, who is on YouTube watching right now. It's not even about Black history. It's about real history, unbiased, uncensored history. Give people credit where it's due. Teach it in schools and universities. Be transparent. That's all. Nicole, one of the things that you and your collaborators have done is actually to listen to the criticism, listen to some of the feedback that you got from the initial project. And you've used that as you've moved forward and developed other teaching tools, you put the book together. Tell us how that criticism helped you, that wasn't just super conservative criticism, stuff that you thought, okay, we can use that, that's helpful.
Sure. I mean, this was a massive undertaking, and I don't know of a single scholar or a single journalist that produces a major work and thinks that they have done everything in that work perfectly. I mean, in the field of historiography, debate happens. People will publish, and then other scholars will critique what was published, and those publications get amended. And that's what we did with the New York Times, the 1619 Project. Where the critique was offered in good faith, we certainly welcomed it, and we listened to it. And we did more research, we clarified, we expanded our arguments, we added more resources. And anyone who may have had some doubts about the project, I think if you read it with an open mind and the more than 1,000 endnotes where we cite our sources, I think you'll see the rigor of the scholarship. None of us should think that we have found all of the answers. And we have to be able to engage in a conversation, because there's history as we kind of commonly understand it, which is something happened on this day and these people did it and this is the result. But history is the field. Is really about interpreting what happened on what day and why. And that is up for debate. You can look at something, for instance, whether the U.S. Constitution was pro-slavery or anti-slavery. Mm-hmm. And different scholars will cite the same information and come down on different sides. And that is just what the field of historiography is. So when some historians challenge certain interpretations, those who didn't like the project said, well, that means that they got these things wrong.
Yeah.
But what it really meant is those scholars have a different perspective on this history, and they wouldn't make the same arguments that we made, but that doesn't mean that it's wrong. History is always contested, and it's almost always contested by those in power, because those in power wish to shape our collective understanding of the world in which we live.
I was getting ready for our conversation today, and I noticed that you were trending on Twitter, which is something that you often do. I was like, what's Nicole done this time? What has upset people about what Nicole has been saying? And it was just this. It's really simple. 1619 Project author Nicole Hannah-Jones says haters should read it first. 101.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, that was a TMZ headline. I didn't say the word haters, but what I did say is so many of the people who have very strong feelings about the 1619 Project have never actually read it. What they've read are criticisms of the project. What they've read have been efforts sometimes to discredit the project. And I just say, you may still hate the project or you may still disagree with the project, but I don't understand how anyone can feel strongly about something that they haven't engaged in. And I think so many people have had their perceptions shaped by bad faith actors and will be very surprised by what they actually find in the project.
I'm going to bring in a historian. Her name is Dr. Catherine Stout, and she has a question for you, Nicole. Here it is.
The critical race theory debate is really the latest moral panic in the history of U.S. education. And we've seen other moral panics before, from the teaching of evolution to school integration and now critical race theory. With so much at stake as we emerge from this pandemic, how do we switch from this moment of moral panic to a moment of education reform that centers equity and academic gains?
I wish I had the answer to that. I don't think we know, because the anti-critical race theory, that was a campaign, was a propaganda campaign. And it was a very successful propaganda campaign, one that many of my colleagues in the mainstream media also helped legitimize. So we know that anti-critical race theory was in response to efforts to really expand our curriculum to be more inclusive, to focus more on racial inequality, to focus more on equity. It was a response to last year's global protests against racism and the 400-year history of Black inequality. So I think the thing that we have to realize is the opposition is very, very organized. These are people who are going to school boards and protesting and overturning school board elections. And these are people who have been very savvy with getting the media to cover their perspective. But you have not seen those who believe in a more accurate teaching of history, those who want a more inclusive teaching of history. You haven't seen them having that same level of organization. And I think that's really troublesome. We can't sit idly back and let one group of people who are not acting in good faith drive the narrative. What got left out of almost all of these stories is white students are the minority in America's public schools. Yet they were the focus of all of these stories determining how we can teach about the history of this country. So we have to be as organized in fighting back for a truer rendering of history, a more inclusive rendering of history, than those who really want to create anti-history laws in order to maintain this nationalistic and propagandistic view of America.
I'm going to ask you to have a look at my laptop and a reminder, and I want to share this with our audience, of a note that was sent backstage to you at the end of November. Let me just get a little bit closer into the note. Nicole with a love heart, okay, this little one loves you. Let's read the letter. Dear Nicole, you are the best journalist in history. I can't wait to see the book that you wrote for kids. I appreciate what you have done. I wish I could be there and meet you in person. Thank you for the 1619 Project. So the 1619 Project, Born on the Water, is a book that you've aimed at youngsters. Tell us a little bit about that and then read us a little section so we get a little taste of what that's like. How do you aim this incredible history and include young people at the same time?
Sure. So 1619 Project, Born on the Water, is a picture book that I co-wrote with children's book author Renee Watson and is illustrated by Nicholas Smith. And it really is an origin story for Black American children who descend from American slavery. It starts with experience that I had as a child and that many children have, where a teacher gives an assignment and asks you to write an essay about your native land and or your ancestral land and to draw the flag of your ancestral country. But of course, because of slavery and the Middle Passage, Black Americans' connection to any specific country or any specific people on the continent of Africa has been erased. And that can be a very demeaning experience for a child. And once we published the 1619 Project, we were asked, I was asked continuously by parents, mm-hmm. are you going to do something for children so that we don't have to wait until they are adults to give them some of this history? So that is what we do. The project begins in Angola, which the first enslaved Africans who were sold into Virginia in 1619 came from what is now modern day Angola. We spend about a third of the book in Angola because we thought it was really important not to begin our story with slavery, to show African peoples had culture and knowledge and learning and joy and love and dance and family.
Nicole,
before
here. Will you read us a little bit? Go for it.
Sure. So I say we start with the uplifting part of Angola, but I'm going to read you one of the dark parts, which is about when these people were ripped away from their land, and it's called Stolen. And the white people took them anyway, kidnapped them, baptized them in the name of their God, stamped them with new names. Ours is no immigration story. They did not get to pack bags stuffed with cherished things, with the doll grandmama had woven from tall grass, with the baby blanket handed down from generation to generation, all the way back, so far back that it carried the scent of the ancestors. They could not hug their fathers and mothers, daughters and sons, hearts thumping in rhythm, clinging to that final sweetness before the parting. No promises whispered from mouth to ear of seeing each other soon. Ours is no immigration story. And then I don't know if your audience can see, but illustrations are just very beautiful.
Yeah, we've been showing some of them. What I love about this book is that you wrote it with Renee. Nicholas Smith did the illustrations, which are gorgeous. And then at the front, it is dedicated to all of your children and really the children of Black Americans who will get that book. And like the little girl that you were back in the day, three or four years ago, they will have that for them. They will be able to tell their own origin story. Nicole Hannah Jones, it is always a pleasure having you here on the stream. So one little thing I want to share with our audience, and I'm just going to share it here. If you're not following Nicole Hannah Jones on Twitter, you need to. It is exciting. It is a roller coaster. And as Nicole Hannah Jones says herself, I am built for this. She can handle anybody, and she's always happy to chat to you. Nicole Hannah Jones, thank you for being our guest on the stream today. Appreciate you. I will see you next time, everybody. Take care.